decision-making, advanced knowledge, and research, but it's just part of a cycle. And if you believe information is power, then you have to remember that getting information is just one part of the cycle. And if you don't give information back to those who you're getting it from, you're creating a vacuum cleaner of power, and you're disempowering those who are actually providing you the information in the first place. So we're going to talk about a lot of different ways of gathering information and processing it, but if you don't get anything back, you're creating an imbalance of power, which can actually be quite damaging. Point in case, in Cambodia, many clinics we've worked at, the guys are asked to report incidents and deaths of certain diseases every week, so that, you know, at a province level or at a national level, they can see when there might be an outbreak happening. The province people or the national people see that there's an outbreak happening. The people on the ground never find out. They never get an early warning. People next to that province never get an early warning. So data is being collected. It's going to go on a nice slide somewhere in some university. A waste of their time. Okay? So, and this is a fortune cookie. Okay, this is a fortune cookie. You don't get to see it. This is a Lao phone that has a Lao keyboard. And I'm just going to start passing things around. This is from Cambodia, and it has the typing of the characters for the Laotian language, which has 26 vowels and like a bunch of consonants, and it takes forever to type anything. And the fortune cookie message you see here says, you will receive helpful information. And that is sometimes what people reporting in information from their phones are hoping for. It's like that they will someday receive useful information. So there's many different types of technologies for collecting data. First of all, you might be familiar with EpiInfo. Here, anybody? Mm-hmm. Right, it's like an access database. It allows you to create forms and schemas. It comes from the CDC, and therefore sometimes the releases of the product take forever. But they have an open source version, which is not the CDC endorsed version, obviously. And it allows you to just design things. And what actually Sherry's using right now as a prop for the projector is a book about EpiInfo, which I'm going to pass around later, because it has some important stuff around data sharing.
This is not good. Mm-hmm. I've already broken the projector.
Okay. Then for desktop, it's also very useful and usual to find out in the field, especially in disaster response, the usage of Groove. How many of you know what Groove is? Wow, more than I expected. Why is that? I mean, why? How do you know about Groove? Mm-hmm. So for those of you that don't know it, Groove is an application that actually was brainchild of Ray Aussie, comes with Office now, and was actually influenced a lot by design requirements of the intelligence departments and DOD of the United States, which creates a peer-to-peer way of sharing information. So you're used to posting files on a website and having forms on a website, but when you're out in the field, you're usually disconnected. It's a bit, you need that information, you need access to those files. Groove is an application, looks ugly, but it's very useful. You basically install it on all your computers, you create a shared workspace, you can plop files, plop forms, have a discussion group in there, and it will synchronize peer-to-peer. So I could be off in a clinic, just with a local Wi-Fi, no internet connection, right? And two laptops, and we could be entering data into Groove and share those forms without ever connecting to the internet. I actually have once had to use Groove in a convoy of 3 4x4s in Lao. We set up from the cigarette lighter an antenna for a local Wi-Fi, and then the people in the back were working in a presentation, and the people in the front were uploading Excel spreadsheets, and as we were going with our Wi-Fi cloud, we were synchronizing the files with each other on Groove. It's a very productive use of that travel time when you're off in the boonies. Obviously, mobiles are critical for any sort of data collection. It allows those who are out there in the field to get information real time. It allows the transmission real time. There's a market force behind people getting phones, as opposed to maybe 10 years ago, where some NGO had to give, you know, this palm-based PDAs to people, and you know, had to be part of the grant. Today, the situation is you go into a village, and the community health worker will have a phone. Family heads will have a phone. And that's a great paving of the way to have personalized two-way information exchange. However, normal Nokia phones might not, little baby Nokia phones, you know, black and white screens and so on, might not be the best to collect some information. And there's many applications and systems, some smaller, some larger, that exist to collect data via from phones. One of them, for example, that runs on Android phones is the Open Data Kit. And Android along with that, maybe. Okay. But basically, an Android phone, it allows you to display a form where somebody defines all the information you need to collect, and then the people can just enter it in. It gets saved. When you get connected, it gets relayed. The latitude and longitude of the phone gets attached. Actually, Gaetano Borriello from the UW was the guy who started that project with Google. And Johan Ockman and others, maybe you know them, have been working on this. And it's been used in some settings in kind of pilot. It's awesome if you have an Android, and if you're like a friend of Google, you tend to get them. If you're running a project in the field and you need to have like 30 people collecting data, 30 times $300, it starts getting steep really fast. So you have to sometimes decide, I will take that expense as part of my project and give them a device that has pictures and GPS and everything up front. Or sometimes you just go, I'll work with them a few hours in the room, see what things people already have or likely to have, and use that in the design of the system. There's plenty of them that you collect. Java Rose is actually the source where the Open Data Kit is based on, but this runs on any Nokia phone that can run Java. It's the same thing. You define a form in XML where you say, patient name is a string, and age is a number, and you upload that to the phones, and the phones can render a form with it and then share it back. Pendragon uses these Palm PDAs, and I think they either will be or should be evolving soon. Another interesting one for simple data collection is USSD. You're probably not familiar with it because you don't have to use it here, but maybe when you recharge your prepaid SIM cards in other countries, do you notice that a little, you have to dial like *123, enter a code, and a little pop-ups appear on your phone, like message boxes of sorts? Mm-hmm. That is done through a technology called USSD. And there's some people who are using USSD to get simple information back, kind of like they put your message box saying, dial one if you have a, if the patient is a kid, or dial two if it's an adult. And they give you like this multiple choice tree of answers to get a little bit of information back. And then another one that's emerging, and it's not to see how effective it is in the field, but the pilots are going, it's digital pens. How many of you are familiar with these? Everybody. How many of you actually have them? Awesome. Am I getting recorded?
No.
Oh, wait. So I brought one so you could play. I did not bring one to Bangkok, and it was a frequently asked question, so we'll talk about it later. Finally, obviously, web, any kind of like web technology to collect data is good. You can have a million applications to define a form, a server, and collect that data. And they don't have to be health-specific applications, right? I mean, I think one important aspect is that even though you might be running programs related to health or things like that, there's plenty of commercial applications that can do the job, sometimes for free. And they do the job well, or sometimes even better than the epi-specific or health-specific applications. There's more market forces for them to be easier to use. Fusion tables is an interesting one emerging from Google. I don't know if you've seen it. And this is just like to give you a bunch of things, and then we'll drill down, okay? This one allows you to create an open database with no schema, with like no predefinition of what columns are in each row. And with a little bit of information about this column is a location, this column is this number, you can map it and chart it in all sorts of nice ways. It's kind of like a spreadsheet, but that provides some smart visualization options. Like between these two, you could build a typical application that records the deaths and incidents of like a number of diseases every week, and then chart them, map them, do equations to trigger alerts with like no specialized software, probably in one afternoon. And there's some more applications like have a specialized like for analysis, like SPSS and STATA, right? That do more specialized work, but you can do a lot with what's out there today. And then finally, there's some SMS applications like GeoChat, which is done by Instead, Rapid SMS, which is done by some guy in UNICEF, Frontline SMS, which is done by others, which allow in different ways for people to get information in the SMS. How many of you have heard of any of these? Okay. So I wanted to talk about these two because I think it's a being this academic setting, it could be useful for you to see what things are incoming. yeah, this doesn't look good at all, does it? I'm going to have to tell you what I'm seeing. And for the record, it is visible.
I think you can turn off the front light.
Yeah. And go do it?
Also, yeah, exactly. Okay, so what you're not seeing here is there's like a black box in the bottom of the screen with some entries that says message, your credit, check your phone credit, load new balance, get a statement, get a foreign exchange rates, and other like options that somebody got on their phone when they dial, for example, *123. This is provided by the phone company, this little menu. And if you have a deal with the phone company, you can have your field staff dial *891 whatever, and they will get a pop-up menu. And you could say, one, report a case, two, report a potential outbreak, three, report a critical disease, three, okay, one for polio, two for that, and just like guide them through entry. It's very simple to use for people. If the phones can't display the character set of the native language, you can put it in their own language. It's very simple to report because it's 1, 2, 3, and you can tell right away if there's issues. One big issue is that it requires collaboration with phone companies, right? So either people have to have the SIM card of the phone company that provides this feature, or you have to work with all the phone companies. How many of you have had to work with phone companies? Great, yeah, yeah, you're the one with a more distraught face. So you know what it's like. where was that?
This is actually with Vodafone and with T-Mobile on line syncing, data syncing solutions.
Oh,
so
there
now,
you go. Yeah, yeah.
In fact, with Mozy for backup.
Okay, great. And the other one I wanted to show you is smart pens. I don't have the exact model we're talking about here, but this is a different one. Smart pens are very early generation still, but they're basically a pen that has a camera and memory inside. And there's a paper that typically has a little set of mini dots, and I'll pass it around. And what the smart pen does, it can remember very precisely the trace of what you're drawing, store it in here. And for example, in the case of a wildlife and livestock monitoring program in Tanzania, they are using it to, from the pen via Bluetooth, hop to your phone, and from the phone, hop to central. So what they get is pre-printed forms on this special paper with the microdots. They get to write down, and they have their paper trail, you know, and the paper-based processes. But information is also going automatically into a server, where either by patients or crowdsourcing, you can decode the handwriting of people. This is a very interesting alternative, because you could print out forms that are not about filling in text in lines, like an immigration form. You could have forms which are just pictures and circle things. Imagine like a car insurance form, you know, where you have the picture of the car and you just get to draw what's wrong. You could have like a whole step-by-step diagnostic, you know, the person has a rash, what is a rash like, and a set of pictures, and the person would just be crossing, circling, marking, and that gets uploaded to a server, and then it doesn't need that high of a literacy rate. Of course, an illiterate person with a $150 pen, but it is worth it if it helps you get the right information across. Now, very simple to use. Do people know how to use a pen? It's easy to teach. You can report a lot of information very richly. This is still emerging, so there's like private companies that will let you go online, define a form very nicely, and then you can print it in your own laser printer or like inkjet printer with a special microdot pattern. But they still can sometimes charge you for the design of the form. So you say, oh, you know, you get like to fill in 10 pages for free, and then you have to start paying like, I don't know, $20 a month or $50 a month for it. Which is great if you're running a pilot, but if you want to do an ongoing project for the country, and that's probably the type of projects you want to do more of, then you have to consider that ongoing cost. And some of these companies, I forget the name, but it was some of these companies actually charge you if you just redesign the form. So one thing about data collection is that you're always trying to tune what information you need based on the information you're getting. And if they charge you every time you have to redesign the form, you can get onerous pretty fast to get that agile sign up. And I'll just pass this around. In addition, the pen has the ability to record. So I'm like recording now, and I go, hello. And if I stop it, I can then go and say, what was I saying here? And it's muted. So unmute it. Yeah, let me unmute the pen. There you go. We'll just click what I was writing before.
Hello.
Right? It remembers what I was writing and recording and correlating that. And of course, I can get it on the computer and I can get it to replay. Actually, you can see your page getting drawn while the audio is playing in the background. It's great for product managers and design and for blackmail. In addition, you can load applications. So this runs Java inside, miniaturized version. And you can do simple applications that use the native OCR abilities of the pen, optical character recognition. So for example, you could have a form where you're asking somebody, please enter the height. They fill in like 33. Please enter the weight, you know, so much. And in the screen, show the body mass index right away so that they get to read it and write it down in the next field. Right? So, I mean, imagine what it can do for on-the-fly data calculation. And it doesn't need to be written. You could even make it so that, you know, if people, for example, if you ask them to plot, lines on a curve, it could tell you if there's a, you know, run a Q-sum, maybe, and tell you if there's an outbreak potentially happening or not. The favorite demo application for this one is the piano. You just draw a little piano on your paper. It remembers the coordinates of the piano keyboard you drew because it knows when you were drawing the lines, and then you can just go. Right. But think about recording audio prompts and recording guidance for community health workers and what it can do for interactive guidance for the person taking the data. Please ask this question, please ask this question, fill in the bottom of the form. If you haven't filled out the bottom of the form, please make sure you fill it. Right? And I think lots of innovation can happen with this. It's still first generation. I mean, designing things for mobile data collection in the field is full of nuances. You know, mobile. Is it going to be using the sunlight? Or indoors in like a Muslim house where it's dark and only the woman can get in, and then the guy has to ask somebody else to enter the data for him? You know, there's all these social cultural environments. Is a person left-handed or right-handed? That can make a huge difference for the usability of applications. And design and constant iteration is important. So my point is, these are still first generation. Who knows how of a dark place it can work in? Who knows how it reacts to humidity? How to clean the camera from dust? And those are the things that can make a project go wrong in the long run. Right? Any questions of any of these?
I'd just say that that's sort of a leap forward from what you normally could use for teaching in a normal classroom, because people can't do free-form drawing and things like that. There are any good, really good universal applications for that. So it seems like this might have a lot of application well beyond the field.
Oh, no, absolutely. No, I wish I would have had this when I was in my university. I mean, I would have done something to just transmit my test answers to other people and sell it. You know, they have an app store, you can sell it. And oh, by the way, all the slides are Creative Commons. How many of you know what Creative Commons is? Great. How many of you think that if you're running a data collection gathering in the field, you actually have to tell people what license is going to be used for that information? Right. Okay, so just to give you an example, the other day, there was, actually in Bangkok, and Sherry was there, I think, there was this guy showing incidences of malaria or like doctor per population in Cambodia. And I have the WHO guy from Cambodia next to me. I was like, do you have that information? He's like, no. So I asked the guy, is that your information? Yeah, can you share it? Well, WHO has it. Yeah, sure. Okay, and can I actually take a picture of your screen and reverse engineer it and put it on the web? Right? And he was like, And this was a classic example of somebody showing something, data, and not knowing how to tell you what are your rights. And as people who work in gathering knowledge, you have to understand what are the rights you're giving people to use that knowledge. I mean, I'm an advocate of open data in general, as long as it doesn't put it at risk of private safety. If you're collecting this data, there has to be some agreement up front about what is the license. Creative Commons is just a way of saying, hey, I give you the right to show it to others, but you have to say it came from me. I allow you to use it commercially or non-commercially. I allow you to modify the data and do additional work on it, but then you have to give it back to me as well and share it or not. It's like open source for information, right? And as long as that, it's like a copyright with more freedoms. So let's talk a little bit about SMS. Why is it popular? First of all, low cost. It costs very little in most countries to send an SMS compared to talking on the phone. It works with only one bar of signal because it works through a low power channel. So it really also uses less battery than using a voice channel. The phone has to activate different receivers for voice to work. It works on any GSM phone out there. The phones will get to your data collection village before you get there. So it's very handy to use whatever is there already. And it can go from just collecting data from 5 people in the field to having thousands and thousands of people sending in information every day. Right? And I wanted to share some of the lessons about, I think we always continue to learn, some of the things that we, patterns that we've seen in this area. So typically you can go from exchanging messages that are really unstructured, which are not really about collecting data per se, it's just information, and it's up to you to extract data from that information. Hey, we have a meeting tomorrow, we're dealing with a cholera outbreak, we'll call you later. And your head already has all this context. This is somebody at some time in some place who you probably know, send you this cholera outbreak, you know cholera is a disease, we'll call you later. Maybe he has to go home and have dinner, but maybe there's something urgent going on. You have all this context in your head automatically. Then there's a structure, which you ask people to send in information in a specific syntax or format where you will be able to just put that in a database and use for analysis, with like separators and delimiters and whatnot. And there's some standards that exist for sharing this information, but they've always evolved around sharing information between machines. And there's nothing more annoying than asking a human to do the job of the machine. It's like highly disempowering. And as people who know about technology, we can do a way better job than asking people to send something, comma, something, comma, something. Now, let me tell you about an exercise that user interaction design exercise we did in 2010. We asked a room full of community health workers to send in an SMS to this number, right? That said, we said, well, for example, you want to report 5 cases of malaria and 3 cases of dengue, right? And we said, send an SMS with this content to this number. Go. Right? And we had it, we were receiving it in the computer, and we were able to let it see it in the private screen. You wouldn't believe what you said. I mean, letters get put in, you get this, right? My favorite one was a guy who just sent the 5 and the 3. So we were able to say, okay, whose phone number ending in ta ta ta? Me. And we go and ask him in private. You cannot offend anybody, so you have to go into private. And say, why didn't you send just like the 5 and the 3? And he's like, well, I figured out everybody else was sending the M and the D as well, so why would I have to pay for that extra cost? Right? And this is not something that you can just go and just do education on, because it won't scale. I mean, when you're talking at this level, you're talking about nationwide, village, you don't pay per character, by the way. So one of the things that we have learned is to try to deal mostly in this space, right, where people are exchanging messages and we just train them upon certain events, send something, include these words, we give them little, plastic on top, little papers with instructions, which say if you see something that you suspect being avian influenza, send to this group, okay, we have groups set up. This message and include one of these 3 words, right? And then that can be interpreted by a human, right? And then also you know that there'll be at least some information that you can put in the database, right? Applications that do this need a lot of babysitting. Yeah.
I heard a talk fairly recently where somebody said, well, how about using the phone for voice and just send that message by talking, because you don't have a like translation problem at all, assuming the person on the channel speaks the same language.
Right.
So have you thought about seen situations?
Yeah, IVR and voice are really powerful. In that case, if you're looking at really low, like out in the field reporting, the cost of calls matters. Sometimes people get paid for their time and their credit, sometimes they don't. Sometimes you give the boss the money for the top-up cards and he keeps it.
So is SMS significantly cheaper than phone?
Drastically cheaper. So one technique is to actually send a message to a number, to a server, that then your phone will ring immediately and you get to talk. So then you get to pay the call centrally, right? And you require some technologies for this. Asterisk is probably the most common. It's a Linux-based, voice-based system that does some telephony functions. And you can program it to give you, press one for that, press two for that, and enter data directly or do the callbacks. So how do we deal with this middle space? Well, the process of going from unstructured data to structured data is called feature extraction. And you can extract data, you can extract features from all sorts of unstructured information, from SMS messages, videos, pictures. You know, when you're looking at a Flickr picture and people tag it with Italy and vacation and so on, they're like adding metadata. And they're basically extracting features that they know about that picture and making it in a way that's consumable by computers, right? And there's all these sorts of feature events, sort of entities that you can extract: time, place, person, the event or the context, organizations, trustworthiness, image recognition. You know, you have closed captioning could be extracted. 4 years ago, we were looking at live translations of Arab newscasts. That was coming in, they were doing audio analysis, converted to written, automatic translation, and then it would go into English at the same time. So you would see like closed caption in English real time. The content had nothing to do probably with what the original spokesperson wanted to say, but that, yeah, at least it gives you a hint whether you want to pay more attention and drill down and get a good translation or not. And then, of course, the structured data that you get is like rows in a database, relationships between those entities, metadata about time and place and things like that. And of course, you have sensors through calibration, sensor readings. More and more phones have sensors. GPS is a classic one. But there's all these sorts of alternate ways of using the phone features for sensing stuff. For example, I guess you could even use accelerometers to test muscle strength. I don't know, you probably can come up with more creative ideas than I can. But there's also people who like do these add-on kits to phones where they have proper laboratory testing equipment that like can do from from like some small, what do you say, stripes, when you put the blood in and it reads it. Well, it's basically a big gizmo attached to the phone that tells the phone and sends that information in. So of course, algorithms and databases is one way of doing this. You know that this person is a health worker in such village, so when this person sends something, it's very likely it's from that area, right? You know that New York is in latitude and longitude in the US, so when somebody says New York, you can place it there. And there's lots of open source large databases for common knowledge. And you can ask, you know, inside a certain country, for people to say, okay, give me the name of each province, and we can use that as a way of extracting the feature. But that obviously has its issues with precision. You can have experts who are looking at how people report stuff, like a public health expert, an infectious disease expert, and extract something. And sometimes, oh, food poisoning and da-da-da. And the guy reads it and it's like, no, that's not food poisoning, right? And he can add those tags. And finally, crowds. And crowds is a very important one because crowds of either remote or local people that are just paid to go through the information, sift through it, and extract the relevant information can add a lot of local knowledge that you wouldn't have and a database would never have. Flies out of order. I was showing all sorts of examples of pictures I take of phones where certain fixed SMS syntaxes are used. This actually is an example of rapid SMS and what people are expecting to send in. I honestly don't know how to pull it off. And this is like reports sent by a machine. It's so nice, right? To people. And then sometimes people get to send number, pound, number, pound, number. This is Java Rosa, and she was another one. That was semi-structured. Sorry, you can't see it. So crowdsourcing is very important. This was Haiti, and we set up 48 hours after the earthquake. A system, the 911 equivalent of the country, got shut down. It was voice only. We set up a system connected to a short code 4636, and you might have heard about this at all. Yeah. And basically deals with the phone companies, get the messages out into system that I'll describe right now, where all the messages were able to put precisely on a map, categorized according to a set of tags, and then based on these tags, pushed to different relief agencies or added to aggregate reports that would go out daily or weekly. Now, then people on FM radios were transmitting, send your place and your need to this number, 466. That would come in Creole, and people would say, my family and my pregnant sister is trapped in this building. We can hear them shouting. It's the school across from the church on such avenue, in Creole. Right? So how do you get to that, to an actionable information by an international relief agency that is not trained in Creole fast? So I'll just jump to this for a second. So what was happening is that this information was coming in, poof, into a system, and then going to a set of people first outside Haiti, and then in Haiti, we're actually found groups working in other cities that hadn't been hit by the earthquake, where they were just getting a queue of this, and their job was just to look at the message with high-resolution satellite imagery, put it on the map, categorize it, kids involved, not kids involved, security, shelter, water, search and rescue, translate it to English, and then with those tags and that location, it would get pushed to the right agencies. Then the information would get displayed on this map called Visahiri. And then if reports were about missing people or about finding people, they would go into a missing person registry from Sahana and from Google, right? And this was done, like every message took through to get through this thing, an average of 15 minutes, which is way shorter than we originally expected. And then finally, because of these tags and these locations, we could use this to start blasting information to people. SMSs. Right now we're sending around 60,000 SMSs every day to like 20,000 people in Haiti.
I was just going to ask, is this something that's been used in other crisis situations, or was this developed on the ground?
This was actually piloted in Indonesia some months ago. These guys have been putting maps for elections and situations like this for a while, and these are just a generic crowdsourcing organization in low resource environments. So to help people get jobs and get basic computer skills, mouse, keyboard, through crowdsourcing jobs. So the union of these three actually was emergent. It happened all via Skype chats and emails in the aftermath of the earthquake. And this system as a whole hasn't been done. This part of the civil war. And then finally, what I was saying is that if you know this woman has something about kids, they have to tag kids, and then you can say to everybody who was tagged with children in this area, send them an SMS saying this clinic is opening. To everybody, tell them to report rapes within 72 hours to get the HIV exposure and everything. Tell people that water and food distribution is going to be happening also at this type of clinic, not that type of clinic. And having a two-way channel was enabled often by extracting all these features from the original messages. Any questions on this one?
Yeah. So the key is the communications right at the beginning. How were you able, since you evolved in that world specifically, to get that 4636 connection and the message out to people in there?
It was a combination of working well with some phone companies and blackmailing others. Essentially, the phone companies knew that cell coverage was important to reestablish, especially phone batteries with not used die within 4 days, small phones, and you have people in buildings in the dark, right, trapped, and you have that 4-day window to have them text out if they get to hear about the number. So there were some trucks also blasting a number through loudspeakers in case people could hear them. So that was, yeah, just going up and down the command chain of the phone companies and establishing that connection while their team was setting up the servers again, getting the generators and power the antennas up and running, getting their network operations centers back connected back to the internet via satellite links, and that was that part. And communication servers work well every day, but imagine after 9/11, all the stories of the text messages not getting through. Imagine if like 150,000 people die, 200,000 people stop using their phones, these servers go berserk. I mean, they're used to like sending a couple of diagnostic messages when there's an error. Suddenly you get millions of errors per hour. The servers were just flooded. We had to help them deal with that. We get the same message millions of times. So there was a lot of technical challenges in this connection. And of course, we have to be conscious of their traffic. So there's also like time windows and throttling that we use to send no more than 60 messages per second, in this time window, no more than 100 per second, in this time window. And our software kind of like does that. It's used to dealing with shaken infrastructure. Yeah,
so this is all coordinated through Sana or?
Through what?
Sana.
Sana. What is that, Sahana?
Sahana? Yes, Sahana, sorry.
No, Sahana is an open source disaster management software that, you know, put it. Actually, they're just one of the destinations for some of the information. This was actually done by a consortium of these organizations. And it was an informal consortium, which was really troublesome when working with the phone companies because it's like, hi there, we're from the internet, we're here to help. And you had like every eager volunteer trying to find their way, and you know, the guy who's worked with them probably knows, you have to be careful with them. So, no, this is not coordinated from Sahana. Actually, Sahana was a pity, they came late. So for you, new technology, they had an existing version, they were doing a new version in Python, they decided to roll out the new version in Python for this event, it was the first time it was getting deployed. It missed all the modules that the architecturally crummy but you know field-proven version already had. And it's a pity, because I think they would have had much better adoption and impact if they would have just stuck with a reliable clunker instead of the new one, which is great, by the way. But they were actually kind of not as big a part of the picture as I would have liked them to be.
Yeah. The newspaper article about this effort had a picture of an old tarp and some kind of server way out in the middle of nowhere. And how does that relate to the more systemic picture that you just described?
Well, the tarp, which has two people working on two laptops.
Right.
One of them is my boss, Eric Rasmussen, who lives here in Bainbridge. The guy to my left was Nico Litara, who was who we were representing in Bangkok. And those were on the ground. First of all, sorry, it's me. So they were on the ground. In the beginning, for example, the outgoing messages, we didn't have the channel through the phone company, so we had a set of phones plugged in via USB to a computer and sending messages as much as we could out to let them know about trauma clinics, etc. Also, in the beginning, there was no organization for crowdsourcing. The crowdsourcing team was a dude that literally, in the airport, ran 100 meters between one tent, came with a bunch of post-its saying, I need a location for these, and would run away. And then with the high-resolution imagery that we had, we would go and say, okay, this one is here, but some people can use the local neighborhoods. It's like, okay, where is this one? Write it down on the post-it, send it back out. It's like actually post-its and cardboard cards is the way most 911 systems work in the world. And it's just the dispatch system. A lot of air traffic control also works.
Reassuring.
Well, another challenge of SMS, and I'll press through a little bit. You can pass on this phone.
Did you pass it? Do you all guys get to see it?
Yeah. Obviously, this is easy. Not too many keys, but you got so many letters. You can compress it. This is the Cambodian alphabet. Each glyph has a lot of like subglyphs to it. How do you fit it in 9 keys? Is with pain. Also, we're starting to work on a project now that uses machine learning to extract what people might have wanted to mean in like structured information reports like that one, where people are expected to send in information and it's put in a queue where a human actually reviews it and kind of like trains the system. No, this is kind of what you, what I think the user meant. And based on that, it learns the permutations of positions of fields, the spellings, the different keywords people use. So for example, if you ask somebody to say, is he sick, yes or no, you'll never get yes or no. You'll get like, why, yes, sick, and all these sorts of variations. So the purpose of this is actually learn the 80% variation that people are doing and capture it as a set of machine learning rules, and then leave the other 20% that you know is hopeless for machine learning to actually be done by humans, right? And just like put it in. Again, it's I think the augmentation of the person doing the crowdsourcing with some hinting by the computer. And it's a ha-ha-ha. It's a pun on the word syntax, scene tags. You know, what have we seen, and how are we refining that? It's all about everything we do is open source. In Ruby, if you want to have projects around this, I invite you to collaborate. Data reporting. You don't see the title. Tumbuda, Sierra Leone. Registration of birth, baby dead by birth, baby dead after birth, mother sick after birth, mother dead after birth. And what you got, this is a wooden box. The wooden box has five little holes here with the same color coding. And as a community health worker goes village to village, house checking on pregnant women and births, she grabs a little stone and she puts it in the box. By the end of the month, she just gives it to somebody and you get statistics for birth. So very low tech data collection, very effective. This is another one we're working on that kind of tries to bridge that. Let me see the other pictures better. Maybe, yeah. Tries to bridge the digital non-digital gap, where we ask people in their local language to report like disease, cases, and other things in this cardboard wheel that you just turn. And on the other side, you get this set of coded numbers. These coded numbers are done by a combination of prime number, multiplication, and whatnot. From the data that the person is entering, and this could be in the local language or could be a picture, right? And you just turn the different layers of these tabs until you get the right one, and then you just SMS this into a certain number, and because we know the algorithm by which these numbers were generated, we know what data is being reported. Because of the way we generate the numbers, we know with super high probability they made a mistake in entering, typing the same number twice, and they missed the 2 here and instead a 3 instead. We know that a 0-3-3 does not correspond to any possible value in the field, and we can validate that and provide feedback immediately. So how do you simplify the data entry? And people know how to do numbers. SMS, important scalability. You can get SMSs in your computer that people send via local gateway or the modem that you plug in, one of those little dongles. And you can receive those messages. Easy to get started, no internet required. If you want to send messages out, it's slow. So one message every 6 seconds. Right, so if you need to send the earthquake is coming, it's not the right tool. Also requires a machine to be on, operated by somebody technical, and so on. Frontline SMS is a tool that uses this pattern to exchange information, which is great if you have somebody moderately techy supporting the machine. This is not something that I would deploy nationwide for like every province, because the modem goes, hangs up, it requires a computer to have power constantly, etc., and it doesn't scale cost-wise. Middle ground, using virtual operators, you get a number that works in many countries sometimes. Easy to get started, high scale, spotty coverage, block in some countries like the US. And by the way, the experience of working with telco companies in the US is the most similar to working in Northern Korea and Myanmar. So far in my experience, and he's nodding. Yeah, so, and then finally, you work with the phone companies, you cut a deal, and you get highest scale, the lowest cost, but you're gonna be there and do the deal. And you're basically, it's like negotiating cheaper fuel for all ambulances in the country with a petrol company. I mean, tell me how interested they would be in that. Probably not, right? And the connection requires some technical skills. What we just got, for example, in Cambodia is for one of our systems, GeoChat, is a toll-free SMS, which anybody can SMS in, and we can send out SMSs for free, that has an open API on the other side to be used by any health application in the country. So if you want community health workers to text in data, they can do it through this channel. They don't have to pay the 3 cents that it costs, and those 3 cents sometimes blocks diseases from being reported, right? So it's a great asset, and it's not something that we hoard. Is a shared asset for the whole country, and we just give it out to NGOs and people programming PHP applications around it. Another issue with data collection, many times you see a process that wasn't paper, you want to digitize it, and in the paper process, it used to go to this guy, and then they used to call this guy used to write it down, then it would go over there, and it would be put in the shelf, and so on, and when people try to digitize it, the first thing they do is like, oh, then you sit in the information here and here, making it very efficient. Like the data path of digital data does not have to mimic the data path of paper data. Probably the reason why people were transmitting information like that is to get verification, authorization, the boss has to control it, right? So you have to get in your system those features in. Approval, review, etc. does not mean that you have to move the data like that. Otherwise, I would have to have my modem and your modem and your modem is complex to operate. And I know a guy who deployed a system like this in Cambodia, and what he does every other week, he just goes around the provinces seeing why the modems are not working. And so he could have just sent it up to the cloud and then sent back down the SMS, and it would have saved him a lot of, you know, 4x4 time. You see, this is what it means. Instead of like sending the data physically like this, you just send it to something that does the right processes, and And this could be living in the cloud or a central machine. Typical. Issues with cloud computing. How many of you know what cloud computing is? Okay, yeah, this is a tech area. So, for example, pointing question, how did I get the government of Vietnam to put their disease information, which affects national security and tourism, to put their health information in a U.S. publicly traded private organization, Amazon, namely? And so the question is not if, because it saves them a lot of cost. The thing is within which parameters to do it. For example, the two ones we hear all the time is I can just get all the data back. I own my data. I can get it back anytime I choose in a format that is standard, not in some binary thing I have to pay you to decode, right? And as long as you have standard data downloads, and they can just go online and say, like, boop, and the data's gone, or even we heard feature requests for ongoing rolling deletes of older data, then they're fine with that. And it can save a lot of support costs. And of course, I mean, in many developing countries, the security of any information system is limited to the security of the social engineering that you can have. So, you know, the $5 for your password and give me all your social security numbers is the common scenario. And having something in the cloud where they can just terminal in removes all those data, physical data securities. And what you don't see here is a guy in with an iPod. His uncle, who lives in the US, gave him as a gift an iPod. And it was the only external pluggable storage he had, so all the public health information for his province is backed up in that iPod, right? It tells you a little bit about data security and privacy risks and so on. Finally, it's an ongoing process. You know, sometimes this little window is the only window people have into the world. So how are you going to show them the world through this little window and all the information they need? And how are you going to let them tell what they need from their managers, from their team, through that little window? And it takes a lot of user interaction design. The technical part is the easy one here. Being out there in the field, doing exercises like that is critical. We do a lot of Wizard of Oz, which is a user experience design technique where, for example, sharing the back of the room has an Android phone with a good keyboard. And we say, guys, we have a new system. The system, you will ask for the case definition of any disease, and it will tell you the case definition. And Sherry's like with thumbs warmed up and the clipboard ready. And she's like, okay, send it to this number. And all of you start texting her phone number. It's not a system. There's no programming done yet. But then Sherry kind of like, copy, paste, send. It's like, hi, how do you like the system? Well, it's great, but I wish it had more information about what to do with children because the case definition is different for children. It's like, okay, good thing. What else? Well, I wish it could be faster. Yeah, we're going to get that. Well, I wish it actually would tell me how to get more information about the disease. It's like, oh, interesting. And you simulate, you pretend there's a computer system already running, but it's really human-powered, and you get a lot of rapid feedback that way. And you know, many times in user interface design, people say about doing a user interface that's forgiving of user mistakes. And they're not user mistakes, it's just what they do. The mistakes is an engineering perspective. So given that is what they do, you have to do something that's empowering, allow them to do what they want to do, not something that just forgives what you consider to be their mistakes. Appropriate design is done by locals. Share skills and get out of the way. What you don't see here is pictures of our innovation lab in Cambodia, where we actually train local people to this design, development, deployment, support, and rinse and repeat in their own language and by themselves. Right? It would be super inefficient and ineffective to have me have to understand the SMS reporting needs of people in Cambodia. And this way, you'll get ideas that otherwise would never be implemented. And what you see here is a post-it being used as a user interaction design technique for mobile applications, where you just draw the user interface. It's like this. And they hold it, and they say, well, but no, I would need to see this information. OK, let me redraw it like this, and so on. So yeah, I know we're late. Are we?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's only 1 hour, right?
No, it's less than an hour. It's actually 50. Fortunately, we don't have a class to follow. So.
Oh, cool. All right, understand. So maybe I can show you other things. If you're talking about reporting via mobiles, cell phone coverage is an issue, right? And it's very common if you have people out in the boonies or in the hills to have external antennas on their phones. You have to get phones that support an external antenna. So you get this little Nokia, and then, for example, this is not Nokia, this is Wi-Fi, actually. But you basically get to talk on a phone like this with a big antenna. extends the range. In Africa, in some places, they ask people to climb a tree before SMSing in the data to make sure they get better coverage. And that's one issue. Let me see other things that we have here. And feel free to play around with stuff. This is a little gadget done here in Washington. That's not done here in Washington. It's done in China, like everything. But designed by a guy in Washington. That is just an audio prompter for recorded guidance. And you can record it in your own language. And you can have agriculture tips, health tips, health case definitions, outbreak protocols, and so on, recorded in your own language. And you can exchange information with others. So for example, if I give all of you one of these, I can upload my audio files, and when you plug it with mine, it will be contagious, and you'll get it, and then you spread it that way. And if you record something, it starts getting spread around as well. So it's kind of like a YouTube, where you can also rank the comment and leave a rank the audio and leave a comment about the audio. So it's like YouTube with comments without the video, only audio, disconnected, which is really cool because this is like $15. Now, this is a public health environment, and I asked the guy, why are we trying it out in agriculture? Health would be an awesome use case for this, right? And he's like, public health sucks for trying out new things because you don't know the impact. I prevented an outbreak. Yeah, sure. I mean, how do you prove that you're actually making an impact within so many years? So he says he tries it in agriculture because he says, within 6 months, I can see dude with orange thing, big green plants, dude without orange things, dry plants, 6 months, I have my use case, right? And you don't have like the churn of staff because it's the same people that are working their fields. It's not like field health officers running around and changing their jobs. So I think that was an important lesson for at least me.
Is that why it looks like a slice of a melon? First time I saw it, it looks like a piece of melon.
Yeah, it is. It's big because it has big batteries that you can buy anywhere, right? And it's really sturdy.
But it looks very agricultural.
It does. How would you make it look more healthy or unhealthy? Like
talking pillbot.
Yeah. This guy should be called the talking books. And if you guys want the contacts, so that's my Twitter, email, blah, blah, blah. Another one, sat phones for disaster relief. I don't know how many of you have had the chance to use one of these. It makes you look like a drug dealer. You get signal pretty much everywhere. And pretty useful. Yeah. So it's Iridium. In other parts of the world, you want other sat phones as well. Yeah, I don't know. I'm around, so I have a phone call starting in a while, but I guess I can stay behind for some minutes. All right.